Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We have someone extremely exciting for you today, someone I'm very excited about, someone that's been important in my life, and I'm so excited to share with you this person. So we've got with us today Nicholas Wachsmann, who is a professor of modern European history at Birkbeck University of London. He's also an award-winning author. He's won three prizes, people, for his book, KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. And he's here because I would not let it go for him to come and join us on this podcast. I've been badgering him for months and months and months. I think I've kind of broken him down enough to come on our podcast and talk to us about how the concentration camps began. So hi, Nick.
Hi, Alina. Thanks for the fulsome introduction. I don't think I can live up to all of that, but I'll try my best.
Do you know what? I'm so interested. We've been dying to do something about the beginning, because we've talked about the Holocaust, we've talked about other aspects of this, but we haven't spoken about the beginning. There's nothing in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of, I mean, you know, when I first came to this topic, researching the history of the concentration camp, this is, crikey, 20 years now, I think, or so. That was my starting point too, that I thought, you know, there's a lot of literature on the camps during the war and the relation of other camps to policies of mass extermination during the Second World War, the Holocaust. But there seemed to be less clarity, at least for me, coming at that point from the outside, about where this whole system came from and then what the links were between camps in the pre-war period in Nazi Germany to the wartime destruction, violence and genocide.
So when people talk about concentration camps now, and I get this all the time, it's always Auschwitz, Auschwitz, Auschwitz. But Auschwitz is not the first concentration camp. There was a concentration camp opened 7 years before this. But before we get to that camp, because we need to set a scene to allow people to understand where we come and why they actually began. So can you give us a very brief overview of the situation in Germany up until the 30th of January 1933?
Okay. So the Third Reich, so-called Third Reich, Nazi Germany, which takes shape following Hitler's appointment in January 1933 as German Chancellor. The Third Reich is preceded by the so-called Weimar Republic. That is the first experiment in democracy, in parliamentary democracy in Germany following the defeat of Germany in the First World War. So this republic rises out of the ashes of the German defeat in the First World War, and Germany introduces or creates, establishes this democratic regime with various social reforms linked to it as well, and a sense of, amongst the supporters of the republic, of moving Germany into a modern liberal period. However, there is lots of resistance and opposition to this right from the beginning. So though there are many supporters, there are also many diehard enemies of democracy, of parliamentarism, right from the beginning. So a crisis of legitimacy in the political field, which is, you know, which you can see reflected not least in high profile political assassinations early on, also in coup attempts against the Republic. The Weimar system then enters, or Republic enters, a period of relative stability in the mid 1920s. But then things really come crushing down in the late 20s, early 30s. The background here is the depression, which leads to huge mass unemployment in Germany, which creates a dramatic economic crisis, and that in turn precipitates a crisis of the entire state. So the state institutions start in many ways to disintegrate. There are hardly any supporters, only a hard core of supporters of the Republic really left by early 1933, the largest of those is the Social Democratic Party of Germany. But by 1932-33, the signs are quite clear. Germany is moving away from democracy in some way. What is less clear is what might follow if the Republic finally falls? And the answer is given in 1933 with the appointment of Hitler as German Chancellor. Hitler is the leader of, by then, the by far largest German political party, the National Socialists. And they'd come electorally from almost nothing, from almost nowhere. In the Reichstag election, that is the national elections in 1928, that is before the Great Depression, the Nazi Party gains less than 3% in the national elections. By summer 1932, the Nazi Party gets something like 37%. So they are making them by far the largest party in the German parliament. They are dedicated enemies of parliamentarianism. They explicitly take part in elections in order to gain power to destroy democracy. And this is what they then do with a vengeance in the weeks and months after Hitler's appointment as chancellor.
So Hitler becomes chancellor. When does the idea to create concentration camps come about? I mean, why are they even needed at this point?
Well, the Nazis themselves never tire of claiming in propaganda that the concentration camps were invented elsewhere. In other words, there isn't anything kind of unusual about these camps which spring up, and we'll say more about what that means soon. But, you know, I mean, there's a kernel of truth in that, in the sense that the principle of holding large numbers of political or other suspects in camps outside the law had emerged in the decades before Hitler comes to power. So we see this in colonial wars in the late 19th century, early 20th century. We see this also during the First World War. So this, the term concentration camp had been around before, but the concentration camp as the Nazis build them is made in Germany, if you will. It is the Nazis who invent their particular type of concentration camp. And the reason they do this is that they are convinced that in order to create this new Germany, which they want to build and which they have promised their voters, their supporters, they will build, they need to destroy all those who they claim are standing outside the, in inverted commas, national community, as the Nazis call it. These are social outsiders, so-called criminals and asocials. These are so-called racial outsiders, above all German Jews, and we should come back to that later. And they are also political enemies. And the foremost focus in the early months of 1933 is on the intimidation and destruction of all those political opponents who the Nazis believe could resist, could undermine the new Germany which they are trying to build. And the Nazi leaders at the top and Nazi activists on the ground are determined to use whatever means that are in their grasp, going well beyond the law to ensure that this is going to be implemented and realised.
Before we move on to the next question, I just have to add in here that I'm so grateful you said that it was this specific system was created by the Germans, because how many times people throw at you that, oh, it was the British or it was the Spanish or some other...
Oh, do you know who kind of one of the people is who always propagated this, who said that? I mean, Hitler himself. So, you know, I mean, this is not a man you want to find yourself in agreement with, I think.
I like that. Can I use that for future reference now?
Oh, go for it. Copyrighted, Alina.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So let's move on to what these conditions are, because when people, again, I'm going to use this example very many times because it's something that most people know more about, for example, Auschwitz. So were the conditions in these first camps, were they like Auschwitz? Were people dying en masse?
I think, I mean, maybe let's take a brief step back first, because let me maybe say something about these early camps and what they look like and where we can find them. Because
go for
I
it.
Think we all have these ideas, these images, these pictures of what the camps looked like. And very often these images are shaped by photos we've seen taken after liberation, so 1945, or maybe movies we've seen or documentaries we've seen about the Holocaust. And I think it's important to stress that these early camps that spring up all over Germany, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of these early sites of torture, of abuse, of detention, of forced labor. These look, for the overwhelming part, very, very, very different to later SS coordinated concentration camps. There isn't a blueprint or master plan for the regime when they come to power, when the Nazis come to power, for the creation of these concentration camps. And that leads to a large amount of improvisation and indeed chaos and confusion as well, as local, regional, SA, SS, police, and other authorities set up their own camps effectively. And they grab whatever spaces they can find for this. So it's not as if there is a blueprint for building a camp. It is existing buildings and structures which are converted, are reused and turned into concentration camps. And you know, that can be a disused hotel. It can be a pub. It can be an old sports ground. It can be an old castle. It can be, as in the case of Dachau, the first SS concentration camp, a disused munitions factory. It can even be, as in the case of a camp in near Bremen in northern Germany, it can even be an old boat. So the Nazi activists and authorities grab whatever spaces they can to set up these early camps all over Germany. And conditions then are extremely variable. And that's maybe the most important thing to stress here, is that there isn't a typical Nazi camp. These camps vary very dramatically in terms of the conditions, in terms of their design, in terms of who is guarding them early on. And that has an immediate impact on the living conditions for the prisoners. In those camps run by the paramilitaries, that is the parliamentary arm of the Nazi movement, the SA, which is by far the largest of these paramilitary units, organizations in 1933, and the SS, which is much smaller. In those camps, the conditions are extremely bad. There is extraordinary violence, verbal abuse, physical abuse, torture, sexual abuse. I mean, there are scenes all over these camps of extraordinary violence being played out. The situation might be or was different in some other early camps, which were not yet run by the SA or by the SS, i.e. by the paramilitaries. And you can see that difference in Dachau itself. So Dachau is set up, as I said, the first SS concentration camp in March 1933. The first prisoners arrive, I think, on the 22nd of March. And the man who gives the order to set up this camp in Dachau is the SS leader, Heinrich Himmler, who at that point also is in charge of the political police in Munich, the capital of Bavaria. But the first guards are ordinary policemen, and they treat the first prisoners who arrive. These are maybe 100 or so local regional communist men. They treat them fairly well. They give them the same food they're eating. There is no violence to speak of early on. And we have a letter of one of the earliest prisoners, a German Jew, who writes that, you know, he's only waiting for the time when they're going to go home again. And this man is one of the first of, I think, 40,000 or so victims then of the SS in Dachau, because it is the SS who within weeks takes over control of Dachau from the police. So in answer to your question, the conditions vary greatly. And in SS and SA run, i.e. these paramilitary camps, conditions are atrocious. There are scores of deaths, but, and that we must also underline, most prisoners in the early camps are still far more likely to be released again than to die inside. So these are not yet sites of mass extermination, these camps, as they then become during the Second World War.
So the function of the concentration camp changes. I mean, it doesn't change just once, but it changes a couple of times, doesn't it? We're talking about before the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, that's absolutely true. What I would say is that the camps always have multiple purposes, really. So even early on in 1933, which is the period we've started talking about here, I mean, the primary focus, as I said, of the primary function of the camps at this point is to destroy or help to destroy the political opposition, any chance of political resistance against the regime. So the vast majority of prisoners early on are German communists, German socialists, trade unionists, and so on. But even in this period, there are already other prisoner groups who are dragged to the camps. There are already social outsiders. There are already German Jews who are singled out for particularly vicious violence right from the beginning. So already in 1933, we have different groups in the camps. I'll come back to that. And the camps themselves also have different functions more broadly. So I said the aim is above all else to destroy the political opposition. That means tormenting prisoners inside, but it also means, for example, intimidating any potential resistors or any sympathizers with the political left and with democracy outside. So maybe we can come back to that later, but the camps are certainly not secret in 1933, nor are they after. I mean, this is one of these myths that camps kind of were invisible in some way. The camps are also used from early on for forced labor. So that is a function too. Initially, forced labor focuses above all on prisoners maintaining the camp, building the camp indeed, often. Later in the 1930s, the SS then, having coordinated the camp system, so the camps come into the hands of the SS, all these other authorities are no longer involved in running the camps. And the SS, by the late 30s, also pushes slave labor in other directions, trying to use prisoners, for example, to quarry stone. But again, we might come back to that. You asked about the other changes in function. And I've already said that already in 1933, some other prisoner groups are dragged to the camps. And that becomes ever more pronounced in the mid and late 1930s. So once the political resistance or opposition is largely broken, more and more other prisoner groups are dragged to the camps. These are some other political prisoners, including those persecuted for their religion, like Jehovah's Witnesses. These are so-called social outsiders, homosexuals, for example, and these so-called asocials and criminals, who make up the largest prisoner group, the largest single prisoner group by the time the war breaks out. I mean, I'll give you an example. One of these prisoners is a man called Wilhelm Müller. He's divorced, unemployed, a pauper, you know, has barely any money to live on. He's forced by the welfare authorities to perform some kind of menial labor for which he gets a tiny bit of money, but that's barely enough to survive. So he sometimes begs on the streets of Duisburg in the Ruhr area in Germany. And one day in the summer of 1938, in June 38, a police officer calls him begging. And that is all it takes for Müller to be dragged as a social human being, as the authorities put it, being dragged as a work-shy beggar to Sachsenhausen concentration camp, one of the new SS concentration camps. Sachsenhausen set up outside Berlin in 1936. And Müller is one of nearly 10,000 so-called asocial men who are arrested during mass raids in June 38 and dragged to camps. Hundreds of them die. Müller is amongst the lucky ones who are released again in spring 39, just months before war breaks out. So in terms of function, we have this growing focus of the police authorities who are in charge of the arrests on social outsiders, so-called asocials and criminals. And also then in the later 1930s, even more than before, on German and Austrian Jews, Austria being incorporated into Germany in 1938. And that culminates the persecution of the use of concentration camps as weapons of terror against Jews, culminates in the days after the November 1938 pogrom, when 25,000 or more Jewish men are dragged to Dachau, to Sachsenhausen, to Buchenwald, the three biggest SS camps at that point, and are exposed to extreme deprivation and violence. Hundreds of these Jewish prisoners die. Others are released again in the following weeks and months if they undertake to emigrate from Germany. I can talk more about that. I mean, some of these Jewish prisoners are held for years, as are some communist prisoners. One of these Jewish prisoners is a really interesting, a young, brilliant lawyer called Hans Litten. And he's on Hitler's radar ever since Litten took Hitler on in court, doing a court appearance in Berlin in 1931. And Litten is amongst the first German men to be arrested after Hitler comes to power in the hours after the Reichstag fire in February 1928. And Litten goes through a number of different camps. He's abused, beaten, tormented. His leg gets run over during slave labor. He tries to kill himself already in 1933 by trying to cut his wrists. He faces daily humiliation and violence and is then found hanged in the latrine in Dachau in February 1938 after years of suffering. And that's another example for these different functions the camps took on in the years before the war. So it is political terror, but it is also racial terror, and terror against those on the margins of society?
I'm going to throw in a question. I know the answer to this question, but I'm assuming that a lot of our listeners may be asking this question. It's regarding some of the criminals. Basically, you said that general criminals were put into concentration camps. But what about murderers? Where do they fall into this?
I hope I said so-called criminals, because quite often, though the Nazi propaganda makes a lot of the Nazi supposed eradication of criminality, which is another myth, another fiction, those who are actually dragged to camps as criminals are not the dangerous, violent, for the overwhelming part, not the dangerous, violent criminals of the popular imagination and of Nazi propaganda, but small-time, petty property offenders. It's important, I think, to stress that the German legal system, with courts, with prisons, never disappears in Germany. And in the pre-war years, many, many more men and women are held in German regular prisons and penitentiaries than in concentration camps. The daily number of inmates in German prisons and penitentiaries by the mid-late 30s exceeds 100,000, whereas the number of concentration camp prisoners when war breaks out in September 1939 is a little bit more than 20,000. So the legal system is continuing in Nazi Germany. It is Nazified, with jurists falling in line with the new regime. Many of them need no persuading to do so. They are broadly sympathetic to many of the things the Nazi regime promises and does. And that means that most of those individuals sentenced for particularly violent crimes like murder would end up in German penal institutions, in German penitentiaries. Those men who are dragged as criminals to concentration camps in the pre-war years, thousands of them who have to wear a green triangle on their uniform, the SS, after it coordinates the concentration camp system, eventually introduces a color-coded system of triangles which prisoners have to wear on their uniform. So-called criminals wear the green triangle, and the great majority of them are, as I said, petty property offenders, men who have many, many convictions for small-time thefts, like bicycle theft or food theft, I've come across cases where people end up in concentration camps for stealing, a few chicken. In the eyes of the authorities, these men are inflated into dangerous habitual criminals. They are seen as a social threat because of their persistent criminality, also because they are suspected of being work shy, in inverted commas, and not pulling their weight. They're also seen by some as, in inverted commas, racial threats, threats to what the Nazi authorities would call the health of the nation, because they are seen as, in inverted commas, degenerate in some way. And sometimes they're also seen as political threats. There are longstanding myths that there might be some collaboration between the criminal underworld and communists, for example. So this is what drives this assault on social outsiders. But it's really important to stress that the overwhelming majority of these so-called asocials or criminals are not dangerous, violent offenders.
You've mentioned previously about being released, so that there was a chance of being released, but when these people were released back into society, could they talk about what they saw in the concentration camps? Was there some sort of silence that they had to abide to?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. The vast majority of those who were arrested early on in the early months of the Nazi regime, and we're talking in 1933 about well over hundreds of thousands of arrests in Germany, the overwhelming majority of these men and smaller number of women are released again, sometimes after weeks, sometimes after months, released back into German society. Sometimes they have to undertake to emigrate, they have to sign papers to do so. This is the case, I've seen this in some cases of German Jews, for example. This is all part of the broader emerging Nazi aim to drive Jews out of Germany, to make life for German Jews impossible inside Germany. But many others stay inside Germany. They often have to undertake that they do not talk about what happened inside. This is sometimes a written form, a written document. There are threats, very, very graphic threats, which commanders of these camps utter before release, saying, you know, if you speak about what you saw here, you know, you'll come back and you'll never be released, or we might even arrest your whole family. So there's intense pressure put on these prisoners not to talk about what happened, because the regime is somewhat sensitive about the truth of abuse and violence and terror inside spreading beyond into German society. But all of these whispers and all of these rumors are impossible to suppress in 1933-34. Some released prisoners do talk to their families, to their political comrades. Some don't have to say anything, because it is visible just by looking at them, by seeing their broken noses, their broken limbs, swollen eyes, and so on, that they were brutally abused inside. So before long, much of Germany is awash with rumors, with talk of what happens inside these new camps, these new concentration camps. And that's reflected even in jokes. There's a popular German joke about Dachau in the 1930s, where two men meet on the street and one of them says, "Oh, good to see you again. How was it in the camp?" And the released man says, "Oh, it was great. We had a breakfast in bed, chocolate, we played games. We snoozed, we watched a film, it was great." And the other man is astonished and says, that's amazing. I just spoke to our friend, you know, another friend of ours who was released again, and he told me a very different story." And the other man nods and says, "Well, that's why they've picked him up again."
So you took the words out of my mouth there, I've got to say, because I was about to throw that in and say, "Can you tell us the joke?"
There it is. That's not the only one. I mean, there are undercover reports which circulate. I mean, you know, an extraordinary story is that of a very prominent German communist called Hans Beimler. He was a deputy for the communists in the German parliament in 1932. He goes underground after the Nazis come to power, but he's caught very quickly in spring 33 and dragged to Dachau concentration camp. And the SS, which had by then taken over the camp, treat him and parade him around as a kind of trophy prisoner. He's beaten, he's humiliated, he has to wear a sign saying welcome around his neck, and he's dragged off straight away to solitary confinement. And the man, the assessment dragging him away, beats him so hard with a whip that prisoners who stand very far away can count every single blow. The assessor over the coming weeks abuse him, torture him, torment him, and basically try to drive him to suicide. They even bring him a rope into his cell. But Beimler, Hans Beimler, is the first prisoner to escape from Dachau in May 33 in a daring escape. There's a huge manhunt that follows, but Beimler manages to get away, and he makes it all the way to Moscow. And one of the first things he does there is complete and publish an eyewitness account of his torment in Dachau, and that is published. It is also smuggled back into Germany, and that's another way in which these rumors circulate through Germany in 1933.
So how many concentration camps were there by 1939?
Okay, so in like I said, in 1933, when this system emerges, first of all, we've got hundreds and hundreds of these camps. That's another reason why the camp system is never locked away, is always to some extent visible to the German public, because in a number of cities, there are dozens, if not more, of these camps. So in Berlin, there are over 170 of these early camps in 1933, which means in some districts, there's almost literally kind of a camp on every other street corner. And you can sometimes see people being dragged to these camps, or you can hear their screams as they're being tortured inside. This is very visible and a very dense net, if you will, in 1933. What happens then is that this system is coordinated in the hands of the SS and drastically changed, in that the SS starts to run a much smaller number of large camps under its control. And these are, by 1939, all purpose-built camps. I said before that in 1933, these early camps are often set up in found locations, if you will, from hotels to boats. By 1939, we have only camps run by the SS and only camps which are purpose-built in more secluded locations, for the most part. Expandable often, and built according to a quite similar architectural plan for the most part. And these are these long rows of wooden barracks, which some of your listeners might be familiar with. And by 1939, by the time war breaks out, there are six of these camps. As I say, all of them purpose-built. And five of these camps are camps for men. These would be the three large camps I mentioned before, Dachau, Buchenwald, and Sachsenhausen, and then two new ones established in 1938 near quarries, the quarry camps in Mauthausen and Flossenbürg. And then we also have in 1939 the sixth camp, that is the first purpose-built SS camp for women, in Ravensbrück, a few dozen miles north of Berlin. So this is the first camp for female prisoners in the first SS-run concentration camp, purpose-built for female prisoners.
And then this basic architectural type of camp is then taken by Höss and turned into Auschwitz.
Well, up to a point, yes. I mean, you certainly see, for example, some of these rows of barracks, in Auschwitz in the main camp. You also see it in Birkenau, on a different scale. But Auschwitz, the main camp set up by Höss. Höss was the first commandant of Auschwitz, as you say, and he had gone through what the SS calls the, or sometimes calls the, school of violence in Dachau. So he starts his SS career in Dachau in 1934, quickly rises from sentry to a more powerful position inside the camp, and is then, as a younger, ambitious SS officer, appointed to this post in the new camp in Auschwitz. Now, Auschwitz, one, the main camp, is, at least in 1940, also found in a way. I mean, this is another old barracks compound, and the SS converts it. So structurally, architecturally, you know, is different in some ways to Dachau or Sachsenhausen, where Höss had been before. But Höss, of course, brings with him many of the things he had learned about the SS terror, about establishing a camp, about how to run a camp, about how prisoners would be treated, about the order of the camps, the bureaucracy. I mean, we tend to think of camps only as sites of arbitrary violence and extreme physical abuse, and the camps were that, but the camps were also increasingly large bureaucratic machines with paperwork, with offices, with departments, and so on. And this kind of model that the SS develops before the war, above all in a place like Dachau, this model is then in some ways the blueprint for camps set up elsewhere in occupied Europe during the Second World War, places like Auschwitz.
Amazing, Nick. That was so insightful. And I'm so glad that I managed to wear you down to come and join us on this podcast. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
Well, I think we left it in an interesting place there, because it's important, I think, to stress that there are these differences between the pre-war camps and the wartime camps. One other point to underline, I mean, you know, I've already spoken about the huge explosion of deadly violence in the camps during the war. So just to repeat, before the war, prisoners are more likely to be released than to die inside. And the very much the opposite is true during the Second World War. But the prisoner population changes as well. Before the war, the vast majority of inmates are German speakers, overwhelmingly Germans, and then from 38 also Austrians. Whereas by the end of the war, German prisoners are in a very, very small minority inside. And we also have other profound changes. The proportion of Jews inside camps grows dramatically, especially from 1942, when the concentration camps start to play a significant role in the Nazi extermination of European Jewry. And we also see during the war a significant increase in the proportion of female prisoners. So before the war, I've mentioned Ravensbrück, but the proportion of female prisoners before the war is relatively small. And that grows dramatically in the later stages of the Second World War. So there are all these profound changes or differences between the pre-war camps and the wartime concentration camps. But, and that's what I wanted to underline, there are also these continuities. And these continuities are personified in a man like Rudolf Höss, who oversees the Holocaust in Auschwitz. He oversees the transformation of Auschwitz from a camp to destroy the Polish political opposition to a Holocaust death camp. But this is a man who's not somehow entering SS terror in 1940 when Auschwitz is set up. He, like the concentration camp system, has a much longer history that goes back to the early period of Nazi rule. And we cannot understand the concentration camp system, the terror and violence during the war, if we do not understand how this system was born and evolved in the years before the war.
That's so insightful. I'm so glad we've managed to plug this gap in our podcasting, because like I said earlier at the beginning of the conversation, we've had stuff about the Holocaust and concentration camps, but nothing where we start from the beginning. And before we finish, ladies and gentlemen, please make sure you do go to Nick's website, which has some amazingly great information, and it also has some videos that you can look at, especially things like that secret taping of Perry Broad, which is really interesting. So it's, for anybody who's listening, it's www.camps.bbk.ac.uk. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Alina. Thanks for having me.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.